Welcome to Lost or Found, the podcast where we think about how we can live happier, healthier, and more fulfilled lives. And now here's the host of the show, Dr. Michelle Choi.
Hello, listeners. This week will be a sharing week. I submitted my book again with working title Untangling, as the last time it had been rejected for more edits. I hope this is the last time. And well, this past round took about 5 months. So far, it's been about 2.5 years since the writing of the original manuscript. Quite honestly, I had strong feelings about quitting this last round. I just wasn't sure if I could do it. Fingers crossed. And today, I'll be reading you the first two chapters. Chapter 1. Is this really my life? There is no breakthrough without a breakdown. Tony Robbins. I felt like Humpty Dumpty, nervously sitting on a wall, about to take a great fall. I had tried for so long to prevent my fall. I tried all means to make it better, but it was becoming inevitable. I didn't know if I, or anyone for that matter, would be able to put myself back together again after my fall. I was starting to see that I could not stop this from happening, since the truth was that it had already been happening for years. I just didn't know it. Could there be some possibility of hope on the other side of my fall, even if it entailed a smashed egg, a shattered shell, a really gooey mess, and mad confusion? I was at a local taqueria in Santa Cruz on a date night with my husband when I decided to leave my career in corporate medicine. Up until that point, I had been complaining about my career for a very long time, with the intensity dramatically escalating every year. My switch from the hospital to primary care made things worse. In the beginning, leaving my career seemed impossible, absurd, and crazy. I had the security of money flowing in, even if the work was hell. I had worked my whole life towards this career. Why in the world would I ever quit? Quitting meant that I would become my worst nightmare, someone who was lost. No, that's not for me. I was on the path to retirement bliss and nirvana if I could only survive the next 22 years. I was super stressed, and I was at the point where I was routinely swallowing back my reflux. Just ignore the reflux, I told myself. Couldn't I just continue some version of this until I reach my retirement nirvana? That night at the taqueria, I was forking taco salad into my mouth and complaining about my job yet again. Our date nights became consumed with my rants and pressured speeches. I would frequently refer to my employers as them bitches. My husband would usually remind me to chill and to check myself. But that night was different. Instead, he asked me what would I do if I were to really quit. I thought about this long and hard, and my answer was as crazy as my complicated feelings. I looked at the crunchy and perfectly oily taco pieces in my salad bowl and stated, I would start a podcast. As an almost first-generation Korean-American, but not because I wasn't technically born in the U.S., I grew up with the inherent understanding that my kind was not meant to quit. Suffer to survive and achieve greatness at any cost, and deal with the consequences later. Achievement was the goal. And because of that, I can comfortably live in our country. Comfort over happiness, and perhaps over our health. But here I was, filled with complete dread. Angry every day and yearning for a sense of freedom. Every day, I wanted to pound my head against the walls. I had no clue what my life would look like after I left my job. It was terrifying, but I was also excited at the idea of being free of their mess. What were these foreign thoughts? I was a burned out, morally injured primary care doctor working in a corporate medicine system that left me gasping for air. Going to a required physician wellness conference helped me to solidify and validate the insufferable feelings and thoughts that I was having. This conference was meant to tackle some of the physician burnout issues that were never openly addressed at our institution. Up until then, I thought I was just delusional. A doctor can't admit that they can't handle the workload. We are strong, not weak. We can't be weak. We don't give up. We cannot fail. It's our duty. When most people find out they have to spend a half day at a bogus corporate conference, perhaps they get a little frustrated. Not me. I was excited about any excuse to get out of the office. Just sitting on my butt and listening to some corporate mumbo jumbo sounded like a vacation to me. Free lunch, having some peace, and going to the bathroom whenever I wanted sounded pretty good compared to being at my primary care job. The message is clear. They only care about the bottom line. And then it begins. The keynote speaker goes into a spiel on wellness. Sure, it's legit. Wellness is something truly important. But I can't help but notice the sheer irony of the situation. We're sitting in a hotel with golf club views. I'm looking at lush green grass in drought-ridden California. The appearance of looking healthy on the outside in a harsh environment takes a whole lot of circumferential effort. We're here for our supposed wellness, but he's talking about wellness so that we will perform better for the organization. Wellness for the sake of bucking up and hitting our quotas. It could be much worse, he tells us, as he shows us photos of Depression-era children. I'm still chewing the provided lunchbox, and my stomach is churning. I look down to calm myself. The acidity is building up, and the food's getting a little stuck in my throat. It's confusing. It's complicated. It's legit propaganda. What? Hello? Isn't the current healthcare system putting us in this situation? It's them and not us. I look around. No other physician in the room is reacting whatsoever. Have we actually become robots? Are we thinking about what is happening? What has happened to us as doctors? The presenter continues to tell us that joy is a choice and that we should be grateful for our corporate experience as docs. We're reminded that the greatest joy is to bring compassion and active empathy to others. He then says in these exact words, "Don't be woe is me, but be wow is me." Yikes. At this point, well, I can't chew anymore. I look around to see if any of the other physicians are as offended as I am, and they all have blank expressions on their faces. They're just nodding. Oh man, maybe this is where our problems began. We've taken on and willingly accepted what they've been telling us as truth, that there is only one way to practice medicine, and it's their way. Have we been making decisions while totally blind? There's a joke in my organization that by signing on, we've chosen to drink the Kool-Aid. I am well aware that I've swallowed the Kool-Aid since I've done everything required to be a good doctor by their standards. But it has also made me wonder if it is possible to cough it back up after swallowing it. The Kool-Aid wasn't what I thought it was, and it was killing my soul. Is it too late? I said it out loud. We were eventually broken into breakout groups for a roundtable discussion. We were asked to create a mantra, something we could say to ourselves silently or out loud when the going got tough. The well-coiffed doctor next to me said without any expression, "Just keep on going. Your bed's around the corner." This one sounded pretty awful to me, but no one else even winced. Seriously? What they didn't know was that I already had my own mantra that I had been saying for weeks. I would say my mantra quietly to myself in the small, windowless office that I shared. I would mumble it under my breath while walking the hallways. I would murmur it when I was on the toilet in the office bathroom. I would say it as I passed my beloved nurses and medical assistants in a low, hushed tone that was just loud enough for them to hear and chuckle. I muttered it to myself in my car on my way to work. I had shared my mantra with my husband, and he thought it was too negative. It was like a tick that I couldn't refrain from. I had to say it. I said it while cooking. I was totally fixated on this statement, perhaps a little obsessed. I felt an energy release when I said it. I felt less stuck. It was a pleasant delusion that gave me hope in my abysmal state. Here I was, ready to say it out loud. I briefly contemplated if this was the right moment. But as I heard other doctors' mantras around the table, all of which had an element of sadness, I decided that there would never be a better time. And then it was my turn. Fuck this shit. Never give up. I clearly knew I had a problem when I yelled my mantra. Silence. But then I saw smiles on the faces of my colleagues. They needed no further explanation. They agreed. To me, this mantra was referring to my own resilience and the possibility of never giving up. I did not yet know what never giving up would mean. The other doctors liked the mantra so much that when the head official went around the room looking for a mantra to be shared with the rest of the conference attendees, my table mates suggested that I share mine. Our group leader looked at me in the eyes, laughed nervously, and determined that mine would not be appropriate to be shared with the larger group, even though most of the room had already heard me shout it out loud. Whoops. But it didn't matter. I said it out loud. I had a moment of catharsis. I briefly felt reinvigorated before coming to terms with the fact that I had a major problem on my hands. This profession that I've worked most of my life for and toward was legit killing me. That's when I knew that my life was a mess and I had to do something about it. It was real and unavoidable. How did I get here? Chapter 2: The Barren House. The devil wouldn't be attacking you so hard if there wasn't something valuable in you. Thieves don't break into empty houses. Matthew McConaughey. I was the perfect candidate to become a doctor for corporate medicine. In my family of origin, I picked up all the skills I would later need to succeed. Always pleasant, attuned to how others feel while ignoring my own feelings, helpful and always easygoing. I could acclimate to any situation. I never gave up. I rarely cried. I pleased the people around me, and I never caused any problems, even at the expense of myself. I pretty much entered adulthood with a degree in people-pleasing, which, as it turns out, was the perfect prerequisite for becoming a doctor. When I was young, I prayed every night and asked God to help my family. I prayed that we could be a loving family instead of four people living in the same house. My parents fought all the time, except for the periods when they wouldn't speak to each other, which lasted for months at a time. The way I saw it, my parents weren't capable of being there for us in the way we needed them to be, so I turned to God instead. My brother and I were not baptized, nor did we really belong to any church. We went as stray attendees to the local Catholic church, where we were the only Asians there, and my mother gave us a dollar each during collections. Even though we went almost weekly, no one really acknowledged us, nor did we get to know anyone who attended. My mother would often kneel on her knees and linger praying longer than everyone else. It was obvious we had more problems, my younger self thought. We were house poor, but lived in a wealthy suburb of Long Island. When we moved to Manhasset, New York, we didn't have enough furniture to fill the house because it was so big. Initially, it was exciting to move to such a big house with so many eclectic rooms and bathrooms. There was hope to fill the house, make changes, and grow into the space. My brother and I would often hang out watching TV in the converted three-car garage that was a family room, where there was a sauna in the middle of the room. We never used the sauna. There were numerous leaky skylights, which were always a nuisance when it rained. However, it let in a lot of light while it compromised the insulation. We didn't have furniture in the living room for many years, and my father eventually closed off the living room and its attached sunroom to retain some of the heat in the house during the winters. Our house was always so cold during the winters and so hot during the summers. My room had a 1970s vibe to it, complete with purple diamond pattern wallpaper and purple shag carpet. It was ugly, even in the 1990s. I seriously had purple color trauma for a very long time thereafter. Ironically, I've been told that my aura contains a lot of violet hues. When my parents fought, they would sleep in separate rooms, and my mother's room was attached to mine with a shared bathroom. She would sleep on a floor mat and apply her skincare while sitting on the floor. She saved her money to buy her yearly beauty products and used every last drop. She would listen to the Korean radio station that broadcasted somewhere from Queens and spoke her native tongue. She didn't have friends, but she had the Korean radio program to keep her company. My father went to work every day, even when he was sick, and he would often work on weekends. Every month, even when they weren't talking, he would give my mother a white envelope of cash. My mother would spend the money on food for the family and stuff for my brother and me, and she would save any little extra that she had. This is how I learned that my mother was smart with her money. She somehow made money last. She would also ask me for a cut of any financial gifts that I would receive from relatives. Sometimes my parents' fighting became violent. My mother eventually became a recluse in that big empty house. She became paranoid about everything, especially what other people said about her. Rumors. She stopped participating in life in order to avoid what she thought people were saying about her. She would pick us up from school at the far end of the parking lot because she didn't want to be seen. My parents punished each other by not talking for long periods of time. Once it lasted a full year, only for them to briefly talk to each other and then go another year without speaking. I learned to be pleasant to survive and keep the peace. I did well in school to maintain their approval. At home, I became their messenger, their go-between. My mother still cooked for my father, even though they didn't talk. So every night, I carried his meal to him on a tray up the stairs and into his room. He seemed sad. I would try to talk to him for a few minutes and tell him about my day. I perfected sounding jovial. It was in this room that he told me that sometimes on his drive home from work, he had thoughts of crashing his car. It was in this room that my father expressed disappointment when I didn't get into an Ivy League school and Wellesley College was the best school I had gotten into. And it was in this room that my parents fought so violently one day that they smashed their framed wedding photo into pieces. I remember vacuuming the shattered glass from the low pile of the carpet. I never cried in front of my parents about how their marriage made me feel. I'm not sure if they would have been able to see my tears. I had learned to be the glue in our family. I could get along with all of them. As a child, I was so enmeshed in their issues that I was aware of my parents' emotional needs and constantly tried to care for them. It mattered more to me how my parents were doing and feeling than how I was doing or feeling. I was their good daughter. I became enmeshed in their being. At nighttime, I cried quietly in my room as I prayed, and I asked for any help that I could get for us. I prayed that somehow we could stay together. I didn't want to cause my family more problems, so I tried to make it easy for them. While my peers at school thought I was really awkward, for my parents, I tried to be joyful and cheer them up. While no one at school thought I was funny, I tried to be hilarious for my mom and a beam of sunshine for my father. I became afraid of conflict and did not feel emotionally safe enough to disagree. I never fought back at school when kids made fun of me or called me dumb. Eventually, it was as if I didn't exist, and perhaps it was easier at school if they didn't see me. I was extremely lonely growing up and had low self-esteem. I was my mother's best friend, but at school, I was shunned, ignored, and belittled. They weren't aware of the problems at home. I was so happy to go away to college. I was so happy to run away. And yet, I felt so guilty. We were never able to fill up that big cold house with all the eclectic rooms sitting on 1 acre of land. My father had a hard time paying the large mortgage with one income, and there were concerns that he was going to have to declare bankruptcy when college came into the picture. I remember doing yard work on weekends with him because there were so many trees on the property. I remember planting rose bushes in the corner near the parking area and tending to them with mulch. We planted gladioli together in the front of the house, and I asked him if these were the flowers of funerals. A lot of funerals in Queens displayed gladioli. He told me I was full of shit. We lived in that house for almost 9 years, and there was almost no accrual in worth after that time. It was a horrible investment. Selling that house, while a relief for both of my parents, also signified the end of their marriage and the end of our family. It's remarkable to think how while we struggled to live and stay in that house, the new owners were able to get rid of it in just one go. The home was demolished and a new house stands over the old one. I stopped believing in God when my parents got divorced. But even as our family broke apart, my worrying about my mother didn't end. She was happier not being in the marriage, and I played a greater role in her life. The paranoia briefly ended. She became more dependent on me, seeing my success as hers. She affected my adult relationship with my father. My relationship with him ended essentially when hers ended with him. I was my mother's only friend, and she was alone. Her life was centered around mine. I continued to be hypervigilant of her emotions and welfare. She lived vicariously through me as I went through my academic struggles. Becoming a doctor meant as much to her as it did to me. I was so aware and worried about my mother and providing her with emotional support and friendship that I did not have a strong sense of who I was even in my 20s. Her self-worth hinged on my success, even though she was jealous when I became a doctor. She became even more threatened when I married my long-term boyfriend. She knew him for so many years, and while she went through periods of liking and disliking him when we married, she hated him because he took me away. I was so enmeshed in my family of origin that it makes sense that I chose a career that asked for the same unhealthy paradigm. Working for corporate medicine, I did what was asked. I met their performance measures. I was pleasant. I maintained outer composure even when I was overwhelmed by the workload, and I got along with my peers. I worked extra hours to finish all my work. I didn't ask questions. Then I started to think a little, then a lot. The work didn't make sense, and well, that's when my career problems began.
Thanks for listening to Lost or Found. If you're loving the podcast, please tell your friends, subscribe, and leave us a great review. And follow Dr. Michelle Choi on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube.